As to finish off the Taz, as noted earlier, 2 weeks ago, the Taz was one of the great recognized Gedolim Rabbanim of Poland.
Are we not possibly making by him? Or else?
No. I spoke about that 2 and 3 weeks ago, that there is a general rule that in Poland and Hungary, they paskin like the Taz, and in Litva they paskin like the Shach.
Wasn't there like one person that like kept bothering a younger guy, and therefore we don't really paskin by him?
That is probably folklore about the Shach and the Taz.
Yes.
And that's probably folklore about the Shach and the Taz. How much of it's true is a good question. I mean, you have to understand, and this is very important, that when people tell you their rules in Kali Psak, as they say, every rule has an exception except for this one. I'm telling you, I know from, I spent a significant portion of my life learning Halacha B'Iyun, and not having to, not only Psak, I mean just learning the Sugyos and learning the Nesakeinu B'Iyun. At least 5 years I could make the Chesed, closer to 10, and I'm telling you right now, there's no absolute rule. Again, the only absolute rule is, the only rule with no exceptions is this one. Okay, that's not true. Hashem Echad, okay? That rule has no exceptions. We found one, but in human behavior, once people are involved, and there's always exceptions. Okay, again, the Taz was the recognized God of Adol, the recognized leader. Poland, as we have shown, was the home to the largest concentration of Jewish people. And as a result, everyone in Poland was a little confused what to do with Shabtai Tzvi. And we're really going to start with Shabtai Tzvi in a real way next week. The only reason why I'm going to talk about it now is because certain people, for some reasons, have... I'm not sure what I should say. If they're unaware or, you know, deliberately falsified historical evidence, I'm not sure. I mean, if you know, omitting something which isn't ki'ilu so nice to say about somebody... Some people will call that falsification. I'm not calling that falsification. I'm talking about when what happened was one thing and something else was stated. So, there was confusion in Poland. What should be done about Shabtai Tzvi? Do you know who Shabtai Tzvi was? Shabtai Tzvi, the most famous of all false messiahs. And I'm going to start next week really going into Shabtai Tzvi. And I can't imagine it's going to take us less than 6 weeks. I can't imagine, which means those who've been here know that means it's going to take a little longer, but I hope not too much, because we have to do Chassidus this year also. So anyway, everyone in Poland very confused what to do about this guy. The guy proclaimed, it's really someone else, Nathan of Gaza, really proclaimed a Messiah. And that's really, you know, I'm like letting out some early information now, but that's really the real problem. Okay, you know.
The three-volume set, one's blue, one's green, one's red, of Jewish history?
I have that, two of those volumes.
Is that accurate on Shabtai Tzvi?
I don't recall. I mean, which book? Whatever, will you ask me afterwards? I have one of those, I have something relatively recent, written by a guy by the name of Anthony Polanski, which I consider moderate. That's it, Polanski?
They all have fancy names.
I'm not sure.
They're big. They're like this big.
I'm not sure if that's
very
what
big
I
type also.
Okay, no, that's not the one. Okay, that's what your name. Okay, so he sent his son and his stepson to check out the situation. For some reason, in this book here, published by a publisher, a certain well-known publisher, they claim that the results were unclear. That's what they claim. No, that's not really true. The historical documentation is pretty well. I mean, there's a lot of things which aren't clear. In other words, the general picture of how widely accepted Shabtai Tzvi was in Poland is unclear. If we look at what was going on, you know, post Shabtai Tzvi, we could assume that he was relatively strongly accepted. Because there was a lot of post-17 problems in Poland, which were really only ended by Chassidus. So. It's still, on the other hand, there is a dearth, which is a lacking of real historical evidence on what was going on in Poland, which is when the majority of Jews live, in the key years 1665, 1666, 1667. Not clear at all. There's, whatever, when we go to Shabtai Tzvi, next week we'll start talking about why that's true. But Anyway, the Taz sent his son Sanua there, and they met with Shabtai Tzvi. Now Shabtai Tzvi had three stated. He was really, I mean, Gershon Shalom says this, and I'm not sure if anyone contests it, that Shabtai Tzvi was probably a manic depressant. He says he was certainly a manic depressant. And as a result, he had three statuses. He was either manically depressed, he was insanely illuminated, or he was normal.
He was what?
Normal.
Normal.
And I don't know what the percentages are. I don't even know if we have... You know, there is actually a psychologist here in the morning. I'm not sure if it's his field, though, so I'm not sure if he'd be able to give a real answer. In other words, a manic depressant, what percentage of the time is he A, B, and C? What time of percentage of time is he manically depressed? What percentage of the time is... You know, I'm going to try to verify this before you know...
Isn't that bipolar disorder or not?
I'm not a big bucky, a big expert in all these things, and most people who spew them out don't know that much more about them. They just saw basic definitions in Wikipedia or something not more substantial than that. We could look it up in Wikipedia and try to figure out however much it's worth. It's worth whatever. A psychiatrist wants to... Whatever, yeah, not now. Okay. Anyway, the answer. A manic depressant is either highly depressed, highly illuminated, highly overly happy, and he's also normal sometimes. So the facts are that when the Taz's son and son-in-law came to Shabtai Tzvi, he was in his normal state. And when Shabtai Tzvi did all of his strange acts, and we would Bezer Hashem, is it going to take us time to get to that? I don't think we'll get to it next week. I estimate that'll take us at least 2 weeks, if not three, to get to. To see, maybe just 2 weeks. But definitely not, I doubt we'll get there next week, but maybe we will. But Shabtai Tzvi did what we would call his strange acts. That's when he was illuminated. When he was manically depressed, he was just manically depressed. He didn't do anything crazy, he didn't do anything out of the norm. He was manically depressed. So the Taz's son and son-in-law came there, and he was normal. And because he was normal, they didn't see anything wrong. You know, they spoke to him, and they spoke to him about, you know, Torah and Kabbalah, b'chulah, and he supposedly gave them over a sod, a special sod to relate to their father. What happened was, though, they met with him in the summer of 66, of 1666. They obviously weren't there for Tisha B'Av, because he believed in eating on Tisha B'Av. And that, they certainly would have thought that was funny. Whatever, we'll get there. That's going to take a long time, at least 5 weeks. Yeah, wait till you hear it. You're going to say, what?
I gotta go.
Okay, yeah, dangle. Yeah. they certainly were not there on Tisha B'Av, because I don't believe they were there on Shavuos, or he didn't fast Shavuos or Patamas or Tisha B'Av. He fasted a lot of other times, but not on Shavuos or Patamas or Tisha B'Av. So it's very difficult to believe they were there on either of those two dates.
Can you pass him like Shabbat too?
No, you cannot. No.
I like his passing.
Yeah, well, that's for Shalom. Okay. And as a result, they came back, and they probably thought he was Mashiach, even though you can't mamash absolutely prove that. But what happened is right after Yom Kippur, the Sultan put the ultimatum to him, which was either die or accept Islam, and he accepted Islam.
The Sultan, the
whatever. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's what's presented in most places. Whatever. It was really the chief vizier, but okay. Whoever was really ruling the Ottoman Empire said, accept Islam or die, and he accepted Islam. And after that, I mean, you would think that everyone said, okay, it's definitely not it, but that's not what really happened. But there are no known mainline Rabbanim who didn't, you know, even if they thought Shabtai Tzvi was a Mashiach until then, they all knew after that he wasn't.
I mean, it's okay to think someone's Mashiach until...
When we get to Shabtai Tzvi, we will talk about it. Okay, there's a major machlokas Rambam and Ravid about Rabbi Kiva, and when we get to Shabtai Tzvi, we will talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Anyway, so it took news to travel back in the old days. So by the time before they got back to Poland, the news already got there. I mean, the news of Shabtai Tzvi converting to Islam was hot news. And you know, some news traveled slow, and some news traveled fast. That traveled about as fast as it could in those days, which wasn't. I mean, it was obviously there was no telegrams and telephones and things like that. I mean, for example, when Charles the XII went from the Salonika area to the Baltic Sea by horse, by fast horse, and did it in, I think, 18 days is the number, that was considered unbelievable. That was considered unbelievable speed. He shocked everyone. You know, whatever. Anyway, whatever, yeah.
Doesn't Imam say that if your life's too anything, you're allowed to convert to Islam because it's still monotheistic religion?
Does who?
Imam.
Does the Rambam say that you're allowed to convert to Islam because it's monotheistic? No, that's a gross misquote of the Rambam.
If your life is threatened?
If your life is threatened. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure he doesn't say that. The Rambam has something called the Igaros HaShemad, which I'm not holding at that point. You know, you're right. When we get to that point in Shabtai Tzvi, I need to go look that back over. But the Rambam talks about it explicitly in something called Igaros HaShemad. I think I have. There's definitely a copy downstairs in the base of Midrash. If you come to me right after Ma'ariv, and I'm happy to show it. I'm happy. I should be able to find it relatively quickly.
Okay.
Okay. No problem. Okay. So that's the story of Taz. That's the real story of Taz and Shabtai Tzvi. It's not that it was unclear. Now there is popular legend for the records. There is popular legend like this. Now this is really fascinating, and this is how the from world, the Torah world, has dealt with things like this, generally speaking, whenever they've happened. People, after Shabtai Tzvi, people were very... No, that happened later, but the question was, what do you do, Kiel? In other words, the hope was to, like, you know, let's Kiel turn the clocks back to before Shabtai Tzvi. And as the historians lament, they attempted to destroy all records, and did a relatively good job at it. Except for the people, see, because, whatever, when we get there, a small minority of people were against him the whole time. There was a middle group which didn't want to say anything, and we'll talk about that in about 3 to 5 weeks.
Oh,
right. Isn't this great?
You
okay.
Do this.
What else are we
going to
talk about in 3 to 5 years?
I'm not sure. A small minority. Then there were people who were you know, vociferously for Shabtai Tzvi. But afterwards, of those people, some of those people retracted. They were very embarrassed, of course, that they thought this guy's Mashiach. It turned out was not Mashiach. I'm not sure if they realized he was mentally insane, but whatever. So a lot of records were destroyed.
Are we sure he was mentally insane?
I'm not. Let's say. On a percentage scale, I'd say I'm over 90% sure he's mentally insane. A manic depressant. If a manic depressant is called mentally insane, yeah, I'd have to speak to a psychiatrist.
What exactly is manic depressant?
I have to think. There is a psychiatrist I know, but I don't know if I have. I don't know if I feel like bothering him for a long time over this question. Anyway, okay. So there is Jewish folklore which goes like this. And this is probably why, even, I'm not sure if Rabbi Goldworm it's hard for me to believe that he's not aware of Rosh Hashanah's work on Shabtai Tzvi, because as it said, as I said, and people, anyone who knows anything about it, agreed with me, is everything done on Shabtai Tzvi post Gershon Shalom is merely Gershon Shalom and commentaries. So no one substantially, he did all the real research, and everyone post Gershon Shalom is merely working with his work. So, anyway, it's hard for me to believe he's not aware of Gershon Shalom, but you never know. Anyway, there's a folklore which goes like this. So Taz's son and son-in-law came into Shabtai Tzvi, and they saw he was sleeping on his back. No. You've heard this?
They saw he was sleeping on his back.
Who saw? That Taz's son and son-in-law. And they said, he can't be Mashiach. Mashiach would never sleep on his back. Why? Because the Gemara Bracha says, that you're supposed to sleep, you're not allowed to sleep on your stomach. You're allowed to sleep on your back, but it's not l'chadchila. And you're supposed to sleep on your side. So here's how I heard it. I heard this from Rabbi Mazelman. who I would assume heard this from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Right, more or less, because that's, where else would he hear this from? There's like, isn't it, that they said the reason why he can't be Mashiach is because it's obvious that Mashiach does everything l'chachilo. And not to do something in the l'chachilo way prescribed by the Gemara, it's impossible that he's Mashiach. Is it brought in Shulchan Aruch? Yeah, I believe it is. But it doesn't make a difference. In other words, if the Gemara criticizes something, then someone who's not Mashiach is definitely going to have to do things the best way possible. Okay, anyway, that's the folklore. Again, I don't think there's any substance to the folklore. I don't think, if there, it would be a real source for that folklore, which I haven't seen. If there would be a real source, then one could say they saw that, and afterwards they said, well, even though he tricked us then, but I didn't see it quoted. I mean, the fact that Gershon Shalom doesn't quote, it's not really that much of a proof, because he's relatively selective in what he quotes. And luckily, there's someone else who did work on it, who did investigate, I don't know all, but many of the prime sources, and brings down a much more complete picture. Yeah, I can't resist. See, Gershon Shalom, this is like a tangle, and when we get there, you'll understand it better. Gershon Shalom has an axe to pick with Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortis. Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortis was the main active public figure against Shabtai Zvi. Gershon Shalom has an axe to pick with the guy. A mamash an axe. It's an axe to grind. And because of that, in my opinion, for a professional historian like Gershon Shalom, you know, if he's from, then I would judge him differently. But he was not, so I would judge him as a professional historian and say that when you don't bring down some of the material that he brings down, that's practically false. He's accuses Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortis of falsification of the evidence for not saying certain things. And I accuse him of the exact same thing. He brings out certain things that Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortis says, and he doesn't bring the rest of it down. And therefore, in other words, to fit his theory down, he brings out the parts he wants and ignores the other parts of Rabbi Yaakov Sosfortis, which is to show you some other things. Anyway, whatever. Couldn't resist that jab. Okay, Vaitin. Shach.
What was the bone he was picking?
That's a good question, and Bezer Hashem, we'll start talking about it next week.
Next week.
That's one of the keys. If not next week, the week after. That's one of the keys to the entire Shabbat speech is understanding Gershon Shalom. I'm not going to tell you. I have a great story. I'm not going to tell you right now. This is really not nice. But I have a great story I heard from a Benny.
All right, but just tell us.
No. Next week.
We're going to see. Next week, just bring a lot of burgers that smell great. Tell us we can't eat them. It'd be easier.
I heard a great story from, I thought I heard it from Rabbi Meir, but then I asked him about it. I said, no, I never told you that. I said, so it must have been Rabbi. Because it's the only way I would have heard this story. When I tell you the story, you'll understand why it has to be one of those two. Okay, my turn. The shock.
Wait, are we getting burgers?
If you want burgers, speak to Rabbi Elsh.
All right.
I mean, I doubt you'll get it, but Bavaka Shach. Okay, the shock.
So basically you're trying to say it's not worth it to stay in this week.
I'm talking about next Sunday. Okay. The Shach. Well, the Shach's name was Reb Shabbosai ben Meir. Again, typically for Ashkenazi Jews of this period in time, he doesn't have a last name. There are a minority of Ashkenazi Jews at this time who have last names, but the majority don't have last names. And the Shach is with the majority. Reb Shabbosai ben Meir HaKohen. He lived, unbelievable, he lived from 1622 to 1663. What? Yeah, that's nothing. That's 41 years. Wow. That's unbelievable. 41 years. He learned by the Rebbe Heschel at quite a young age. Not clear exactly. It says, my sources say he went to yeshiva, which was for, you know, Kilo, at those days they were probably 18-year-olds, 18 to 20-year-olds. He was 12. Well, 12-year-olds then weren't 12-year-olds of today, you understand. 12-year-olds who weren't going to yeshiva were going to work. Not all of them, but it was a common thing for a 12-year-old to go to work. A 14-year-old? Definitely. 14-year-olds went to, if you weren't in yeshiva, you went to work. That's how things went. Even until 1920, 14-year-old who wasn't in yeshiva or in high school, and there were a lot of people who weren't in either one. They were going to work. Okay, so as you can see, he was a prodigy. He started writing his perush on Yoredeya at 18. Ki'ilu Shana Aleph. He finished it by the age of 24.
It's mad.
That it's you don't understand. The Shach is unbelievable. The Shach and Yardaya, it's unbelievable. He wrote it between the ages of 18 and 24. And as we sort of mentioned before, the Minig HaPsak, the custom of how to pasken in Litta, was like the Shach. And as I mentioned 2 or 3 weeks ago, when Rabbi Salvation gave Smicha Shir back a long time ago, he only bothered saying the Shach. You know, to carry on the Minig Litta, to give over the Minig Litta to his Talmid. He was on the Bezdin of Vilna at the age of 21. The sefer called Shach stands for Sifsei Kov. Okay. I wrote out of order. Okay. Shach on Yoredeya, the Shach on Yoredeya combines Perush, explaining Shulchan Aruch, explaining why Shulchan Aruch and Rambam say things, with Hasaga, with arguing, bringing another, when he doesn't like the Hachra, the way the Shulchan Aruch or the Rambam Paskin, he lets you know about it. As we mentioned, again, 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Taz is, as its name is, Ture Zav. The Taz is half talking about the Tur. He talks about the Tur almost as much as he talks about Shulchan Aruch. The Shach in Yoredeya, not that he never speaks about the Tur, because he will speak about the Tur if it's pertinent. But the Taz, the Shach on Yoredeya is Shulchan Aruch based. It's a Shulchan Aruch based commentary that the main purpose and thrust of the commentary is to explain Shulchan Aruch and Ramah, and when he doesn't like it, to argue. When it's not, he doesn't like it, you understand, Halacha doesn't come from left field. It comes from the sugyas and the poskim, as they say. And so when he feels the substance in the earlier poskim is not the way that the Shulchan Aruch and or Ramah Paskin, then he certainly lets you know about it. And of course, see, in Yoredeya, as mentioned, I mentioned this last year, so I guess no one heard that, so I'll mention it this year. The Shulchan Aruch in the middle part of, in the first two-thirds of Yoredeya is very complicated, not the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah. Because the Ramah wrote three chiburim, he wrote three different works about the same things. He wrote the Haggah and Shulchan Aruch. He wrote Darkei Moshe, his Haggos on the tour. And he also wrote something called Taras Chattas. I'm pretty sure Taras Chattas doesn't do Nina. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure. As a result of him writing these three things, it's complicated, because they're all written by the same person. And the Ki'ilu don't always say the exact same thing, or whatever. I mean, it could get really complicated. So part of what the Shach is going to do in Yoredeya, especially because he's Ashkenazi, he's worried about the Ramah, and he's going to try to figure out what really is the Shita Sarama. That's a major thrust in the Shach in Yoredeya. He also wrote in Choshen Mishpat. As I mentioned, I spent about 10 years learning Halacha B'Iyun. I almost did all of that in Aruch Chaim and Yoredeya. I learned very little Choshen Mishpat B'Iyun. So I'm not nearly as opinionated about Choshen Mishpat as I am about Aruch Chaim and Yoredeya. But people claim, and I don't learn enough of this to verify this is true, but they say that the Shach in Choshen Mishpat doesn't comment as much. He only argues. In other words, in Yoredeya, the Shach comments. If he doesn't like the Hachra, if he doesn't like the decision, then he argues. But in Choshen Mishpat, he doesn't do that. In Choshen Mishpat, almost all of his comments are argument. Okay, I'm not sure if that's true. You know, if you ever zochet to learn Choshen Mishpat B'Iyun, so then you can come back and tell me about it, and I'll file it. Hopefully I won't forget it. Now, something else the Shach does like this. The Shach and the Taz printed their Pirushim, they're running right around the same time. And the Shach, after he saw the Taz, he wrote something called Nekudas HaKesef. Okay. Taz means Turei Zav, literally means pillars of gold. So the Shach wrote his critique of the Taz, calling it Nekudas HaKesef, the silver dots. In other words, you think it's all gold, it's not all gold. Some of it's only silver. And he, at length, attacks the Taz. When the Taz, in other words, a lot of the problems in Shulchan Aruch and Ramah are like very basic. Ki'ilu, you know. They're very basic. And the Taz gives his explanation. And the Shah sometimes gives it. Sometimes they say the same thing. Sometimes they say something else. So when the Taz says something different than the Shah, then the Shah will tell you in the Nekudas HaKesef why he doesn't like the Taz. Why he thinks the Taz is wrong. Now that was only printed well after the Taz and Shah both died. So the Taz never was able to respond to the Shah's attacks in the Nekudas HaKesef. The Shah gets the last word here. But he doesn't, because of course the Gedolei Achronim, the Prima Godim, and the Revush Yisrad, and others, all are going to be dealing with the Shach and the Taz and Yoredeia. That's the meat of Yoredeia. That's what's the Machlok Shach and Taz. The Machaber says this, the Rabbah says this, Machlok Shach and Taz. Or no Machlok Shach says this, the Taz says that. That's the meat of it. If you don't believe it, go ask someone in the Kris Kol and they'll confirm that. So that's the Shach is a very important contributor to this whole setup. Okay, getting back to the history. And just one last thing. He also wrote a sefer called Tafu Koin. If you ever learn Bab Metzia seriously, there's a sugya and Avav and Bab Metzia, which is the most important sugya in terms of understanding Tfisa. Tfisa means grabbing. It means when there's a halachic question about who owns something, and you go and seize it. Possession, as they say in English common law, possession is 9/10 of the law. In the halacha, it's a lot more complicated. I mean, that's sort of true also, because hamotzi mechavero v'raya. Hamotzi mechavero, if you want to take away from your friend, you bring the proof. So Takvu Kayin is about the most important sugya there, which is the sugya of Takvu Kayin. It's a relatively large chibur, relatively large, piece of work, also authored by the Shach. Okay, the Shach's life, obviously, the middle of his life was interrupted by Tachvatat. Tachvatat, as mentioned, were the Cossack invasions and rebellion against the Poles. The real truth is that's the beginning of the end of Poland as a great country. And even after that, it's the beginning of the rise of Russia as a great country, is the beginning of the end of Poland as a great country. And there were a lot of other conflicts a little later in the Shah's life. They affected more, Belarus, White Russia, Lithuania, than they did the rest of Poland. And as he was living in Vilna, he ran away from Tachvatat, he came back, he ran away another time because of, the Swedish-Russian invasions of northern Poland. He ended up, as a result of this, he ended up in Morovia. Morovia is, today the Czech Republic. That's where he ended up at the end of his life. Okay, one last thing about the Shach. There's a very famous piece of folklore, which I'm not sure if it's true or not. He actually doesn't bring it. It's not brought in the early Achronim. There's a very famous piece of folklore, which Marcus Lehman made into a whole short story. And that is the famous legend of the Shach's daughter. I forgot to ask my wife. As I recall, the Shach's daughter's name legendarily was Esther, but maybe it was Sarah. It was one of those two names, as I recall. I forgot to ask my wife about it. Okay, what? Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm just trying to say the folklore over as accurately as possible. Even if it's only legend and folklore, doesn't mean we shouldn't try to be accurate in saying it over. Okay, legends like this. In Tachvatat, the Shach was 26, 27. And legend says he had a 4-year-old daughter, or 3 or 4-year-old daughter, who was kidnapped by the Cossacks and sold over, or given over, ransomed over by a noble person and raised as a non-Jewish noblewoman.
I was there.
No, wait a second. We're not done. And much later in her life, 20 years later, approximately, it can't be 20 years, I don't say 15 years later, 48, he only lived another 15 years, but let's say 15 years later, when she was a young lady, she was able to recognize her father. She knew she was Jewish. but she was able to recognize her father because she heard him prepare a drasha, Shabbos, either Shabbos Shuva or Shabbos Agadol drasha. She heard him prepare it when she was 4, and she was able to remember it, you know, Ki'ilu for 15 years. And when she heard him say it with the same drasha, she was able to identify the Shach as her father. Marcus Lehman has a very, I guess it's not so well known, but he has a relatively well known, you know, popularization of this story, which of course he takes a lot of poetic license on, and I'm not sure how much of, you know, how much of it is based on fact and how much of it is based on his, you know, what's the right words?
Imagination.
Yeah, thank you. That's a famous story, the famous legend of the Shach and the Shach Star. Great, we're really going to do this. I'm really happy. Okay. Magen Avraham. A shame. We're not going to be able to torture them next week with the Magen Avraham. Isn't that sad? Okay. The Magen Avraham. The Magen Avraham's name was Reb Avraham Gombiner. It's not really a last name. He was from a place called Gombin. And that was a very classic way that Jews referred to other Jews in Poland and Russia, was from the city they were from. Like they call Gombiner. G-O-M-B-I-N-E-R. He's from a city called Gombin. He's the last of the major Mefarshei Shulchan Aruch. He wrote on Aruch Chaim. Again, today's a night of a lot of folklore. Folklore and legend says that he was originally a 5th grade Rebbe, approximately. 4th, 5th, you know, Cheder Rebbe, not very young, but not very old. And Gombin. He was originally from Gombin in Kalish. And the Shach was coming through because his son was marrying someone from Kalish. The Shach gave the Pali. The Shach was, of course, very famous because he had printed his Sefer Sifsei Kohen in 1664, at the age of 24. So he's a very famous person. 1646. In 1646, at the age of 24. So this is about 10, 12 years later. Shach's a very famous person, comes through. A famous rabbi comes through, everyone asks him to speak. He speaks in the shul. And he posed a question.
And the guy came over and said,
He posed a question and said, this is a question I don't have an answer for. Now, the way I saw the story brought was one of the Magen Avraham's Talmidim, one of his students, was at the drasha. And he went to Cheder the next morning. And he told his Rebbe, you know, the Shach is here. And he said the following question. The Shach was here and he said the following question. That's how I'm saying that the students must have been, you know, 4th to 6th grade approximately. Because if not, it doesn't make any sense that they could have been able to say, you know, say over a question if they were like 6 years old, you know. Unless they were like Reb Zalman from Volozhin or the Shach himself. And I can't remember when a 6-year-old or the Vilna Gaon. I mean, how's a 6-year-old? Right. How's a 6-year-old going to say over a question accurately? Okay, whatever. I can start naming other people also. You ever heard of Sammy Reshevsky? No? Okay. He was a chess prodigy. He when he was 6, he did a world tour and defeated masters. One of the people he beat in a game was Max Yu, who was 10, 12 years later world champion. I mean, he was a weak world champion, but you understand, even a weak world champion is something. Okay. Now, anyway, so it could be that he had an unknown Ilui as a first grade rabbi. But let's assume that's why I edited the story slightly and said I'm assuming it was 4th to 6th grade, or maybe even a little later, 7th or 8th, maybe even. But anyway, Talmud told him over the question, and the Magen Avraham said, "Okay, you want an answer? Here's an answer." And then the Talmud went to the Shach and told him the answer. And the Shach said, "Who told you that?" He said, "My Rebbe, he's your Rebbe." He's a Cheder Rebbe over here. So he went to the Magen Avraham, and he spoke to the Magen Avraham in learning. He spoke a long time. And the Shach said to everyone in the city that, you know, you have this guy teaching 5th grade, he's really something else. And he's much more than a 5th grade Rebbe. Now there's a similar legend in the Four Captives. You know, that's what you're confusing it with? Okay, there's a similar legend with the Four Captives. The Four Captives, that's how this period of the Rishonim really started. One of them was sent to Spain. I don't remember his name right now offhand. He was sold as a slave to Spanish, to the Jewish community in Toledo. Or Barcelona. I think Toledo makes more sense. And he was, you know, the Rav was working for somebody as a slave. There was a servant. And he went to the drasha the Rav gave on Shabbos. The Rav said something, and he's sitting all the way in the back, disproves it. And the whoever the rabbi was, he was able to see this person knew a lot more than him. And he went from being a servant to being, you know, to being the head of the community. That's a similar legend. Okay. And what's the Magen Avraham known for? He's known for being the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham is a parish only in Or HaChaim. It's only in Or HaChaim. Now, if we rate the three big pirushim, which is Shach, Tazi, and Magen Avraham, that's how I rate them in order of how easy they are. The Shach is the easiest one to learn. The Taz is a little harder. You know, when you learn your day, you say, okay, the Shach and the Taz, the Shach and the Taz, the Shach's, you know, much smoother. The Taz is a little more difficult. But then if you learn Or HaChaim, you say the Taz is easy and the Magen Avraham is impossible. The Magen Avraham is cryptic. It's cryptic, terse, a very difficult parish. But however, Gedolei HaRavim afterwards, there's no question that from the merest movement of Magen Avraham's hand or pen, halacha's moved. And, you know, Gedolei HaRavim afterwards from Magen Avraham and on, have all recognized the Magen Avraham as, you know, I wouldn't call him, you know, again, every rule has its exceptions, but to call him the final authority is obviously not, is obviously an inaccuracy, but there's no question that the main kfias, the main way halacha is decided and worked with in Or HaChaim is based on Magen Avraham. There's no question about it. It does not matter that Sephardi, Ashkenazi, it doesn't make any difference. The Magen Avraham is the Magen Avraham. He is key. Key is not even strong enough. Now, it's such a difficult parish that there's a parish printed on it in Or HaChaim called Machatzas HaShakel in order to explain what he wants. That's how difficult it is. Of course, the Prima Gadim comments on the Shach and the Taz both in Or HaChaim and Yerod Deah. So to say the Prima Gadim was written just to explain the Magen Avraham because it's difficult is not really accurate. But the Machatzas HaShakel was explained, was the Prima Gadim printed in the back, in the old days, the Prima Gadim was printed in the back of Shulchan Aruch, and the Machatzas HaShakel, to explain the Magen Avraham, was printed on the page. Because the Magen Avraham needs, it's terse, it's very brief. There's another problem like this with the Magen Avraham. One of the reasons why the Magen Avraham wrote the Sefer was there was a different perush accepted to Or HaChaim in his day. And that was a perush called Olas Tamid and Olas Shabbos. It was written by one of the Rabbanim, one of the rabbis from Krakow, wrote it, one of the Dayanim from Krakow wrote it, to be mefarish to explain Or HaChaim. And Magen Avraham did not like it. And he critiqued it very strongly. And as a matter, it's ironic that the only reason today when anyone gets Olas Shabbos, Olas Tamid, Olas Shabbos, is in order to figure out what the Magen Avraham wants. Now, the Olas Shabbos, Olas Tamid is practically not important. La-halacha. Later people are. In other words, Aliyah Rabbah. There are people who argue the Magen Avraham after Aliyah Rabbah. There people have the Magen Avraham, you know. But the importance of Olas Shabbos, Olas Tamid is to understand the Magen Avraham. That's the importance. Now there's another parish called Levushi Srad by, I wouldn't call him a late Achad, but by a later Achad. It's not really solely written to explain Magen Avraham, but he spends a large amount of time explaining the Magen Avraham. So that just goes to show you again how complicated and difficult the Magen Avraham is. Anything else? Yeah, okay. Oh yeah, well we'll get to that. Okay, now, the Magen Avraham does occasionally quote the Shach, which is fascinating, because we don't have the Shach on Or HaChaim, and there are two possibilities. One, he had the Shach on Or HaChaim. Or two, when he met the Shach, which again, according to folklore, he could have met the Shach. I mean, it's historically, we're not talking about people who live in different places, but he could have definitely met the Shach. So, either the Shach did write something on Or HaChaim and he had it, or he met the Shach, and there's not that many comments. I can't give you the exact number. You have to ask like a real Yehudi to get the exact number. But I would be surprised if it's even 100 quotes. It's probably even less. Where he quotes the Shach on Or HaChaim. And that would lead one to believe it is possible that he met the Shach more than once. We know of one time. And those comments were orally given over to him, not that they're quotes from a sefer that we don't have anymore. That is what I can't prove that, but I think that's just as plausible as saying that the Shach wrote something on Or Chaim, which we have no other record of besides these random quotes in Magen Avraham. So he wrote on it. Who says he really wrote on Or Chaim? Maybe he didn't write it in Or Chaim. Maybe the Shach, maybe the Magen Avraham who met the Shach, got these comments and just put them in his parish. So that's my contribution, historical theory for that for the Eid. Okay, one last thing, and this is why I said I told some of the guys, and some guys who were thinking of coming. They says anything to do with Shaptei Tzvi? I said not that much, a little bit. We'll go around Shaptei Tzvi. Okay, one of the key issues in Shaptei Tzvi, and it's really been an issue since the Arizal, is synthesis. We have classic Torah Shas and Poskim, and we also have from Ari Kabbalah. Mister, how do you synthesize the two? What do you do with it? What about with the contradictions? What about this? What about that? What about the next? Magen Avraham is a very important player in this issue. Magen Avraham does what I call the mainline approach. Historically, people give credit to the Vilna Gaon for this, but the facts are, is Magen Avraham does the exact same thing. And that is when there's no contradiction between Kabbalah's Ari, and accept the nigla, then it is synthesized and incorporated. And when there is, we say we don't really understand what the Nistar wants, and we're certainly not going to do like, you can't go against Shas and Poskim because of something in Nistar. That the Magen Avraham constantly does. Now, we don't know anything about the Magen Avraham and Shaptei Tzvi. That's a massive question mark, which we have no idea about at all. What did the Magen Avraham do this as a... I mean, he wrote his Sefer after Shaptei Tzvi. The Sefer was written in the late 1660s, early 1670s. That's after Shaptei Tzvi. Well, did the Magen Avraham do that as an unofficial response? There's no way to prove it, but it's definitely possible. Okay, fine, guys. Okay, we're not going to start Shaptei Tzvi. We have two minutes. Believe it or not, I'm not going to start Shaptei Tzvi. There's 2 minutes, not enough time to get anything serious in. Okay.